Colin Ryder Richardson, excuse me, Colin. This is reel four.
When I came back, I had a bit of a time off from going to school to adapt and also to get some clothing. And that was beginning to get difficult. And I know the problems of buying further clothes for me. And I think, in fact, clothing was on the ration then, the coupons. In the meantime, the newspapers were filled with the story and looking at it from all angles. Why should the Germans torpedo a child evacuee ship? This is another thing of barbarity. The Germans responding and saying they didn't know about it. Then, of course, there was the aspect of how I had survived when other people who were older and presumably more robust than myself. And then I was pointing out that I was wearing this patented life jacket that had been offered to the Navy, but they hadn't taken it up, which is a much more practical form of life-saving equipment than the cork life jackets of the time. So that was the one thing that was of great interest. A lot of people had said that I'd been a hero. And I found this very difficult to take because other children, my friends around, started to sort of ask me in either one way in admiration or another way in sneering. And whichever way, it upset me considerably because I had witnessed such tragedy and death at an age which, in my view now, at the age of 71, is an age when people are most vulnerable because you're moving into a puberty area and it is more or less acknowledged that at an earlier age things pass you by without much awareness. And later on, you are able to make a development of your own awareness, a nationalisation. But at this brink point between childhood and the beginning of manhood, there is a point of vulnerability, and that the things you experience you can see in every detail, and you may not be able to rationalise it because you're not sufficiently adult. And it's quite an interesting area because when we have these reunions, people say, why we keep coming back to these reunions when all my life we've been trying to forget this, but it's so firmly implanted in our mindset and there is no way that it can be eradicated. It is totally indelible. It is stamped on our persona. And of course, it really, that total experience at that time of trauma changed my total life because I could see only that I was destined for the armed forces. I was 11, the war was now developing, it was getting bigger. And as sure as anything, as soon as I reached 16, I would be recorded as being an available citizen for armed forces at the age of 18, which was only going to be 5 or so years hence. And everybody was coming up to me and saying, oh, you're the boy hero. I understand you've been, your name's been submitted to the King, King George VI. For an award for what you did at sea. And this was, on the one hand, a nice surprise. Never thought it was going to be anything like that. But felt that maybe the truth had been slightly overstated, but then it's other people's perceptions are not mine, and I was only a child. On the other hand, I felt very awkward about it, because children tend to conform. You wear a different piece of clothing to normal, then they ask you why, they ridicule or praise you, as the case may be. But to be given an award and for it to be published became awkward to me. I mean, I was honoured for the honour, but the, as many people say, when they get the award, it's really not for me, but for those who were with me and those who perished. And so my life was then occasioned by, oh, you're the Colin, the city of Benares, or you're on that line that was torpedoed, now what was its name? And all the time you're asked to bring out the details, and so on and so forth. And I suppose you immediately picked up, no, I wasn't. Well, you know, I suppose you were safe, and no, I wasn't. And all the time you're honing the story in your own mindset over and over again, giving out details here, then everywhere. And people are either recalling horror or saying what a brave lad you were and all that stuff. And frankly, you rather wish the whole thing hadn't happened and you weren't subjected to what are genuine inquiries and welfare or concern and welfare and bravery or whatever it was. Because we're in a situation where you're on one side of the situation and they're on the other side inquiring and you're giving the answers. And the same thing with the reporters. You don't want to feel that you were anything more than part of a general big tragedy. Yet letters came from all over the world asking about their relatives on the ship and whether I'd seen them and had known them and what they had said and what they'd worn and so on and so forth. And people have said, I'd made a name for myself and, you know, what was I going to do? And all I could say was I think that I'd be going into the Navy when I'm called up. And this seemed to be almost setting myself on my future at the age of 11. But I have to say that I really mind keenness and eagerness for the future before I went totally evaporated. I felt that there was no future, there was no question of learning at school for a trade or a profession. The war was going to go on. I was sufficiently acute and aware that the German army was highly efficient and it wasn't going to be over within a short period. It was going to be a long war, and the First World War was long enough that it looked as though this one was going to run the same length. Well, that was considered at the time to be pessimistic to talk about it. I was sufficiently understanding of the kind of scenario we were in, that unless we got America into the war and everything else, we sitting on our little island was hardly likely to beat a tough continental enemy who was guarding the shores of Europe, continental Europe, with greater energy and capacity than we possibly had. We were all right with the Navy, but everything else was pretty disastrous. My future seemed to be get yourself fit for the Army or the Navy. So learning a language like French or Latin seemed to be at the height of ludicrous. Why? The question, you know, what are you going to do when you leave school, seem to have any one answer, and that was an inevitability going into the services, like all the people who were at school and older than me were doing. And so when the war ended, I was in this vacuum of going into the Navy, but having had the experience that I had had, I really was not sufficiently proficient in my school and training. I had passed my school exams, which was actually a surprise to my parents. And I hadn't realised quite just how much they'd done for me to try and get me over this trauma.
Could you talk to them, sort of, really openly about your feelings? I wonder at 11, the age of 11,
no,
could you express these feelings then?
I expressed them to tears. In fact, what they did do, and I hadn't appreciated until about 50 years, 40 years later, while I was at the Welsh farm, my parents got to know another family, and there was a daughter about my age, and what they'd arranged, and I hadn't appreciated, was they just told me that somebody was coming around for tea, mother and daughter. And what the daughter had been told was that because she was my age and being feminine, that maybe she was asked if Colin started talking about his wartime experiences, she was just sit there quietly, nod and agree, and just be an open heart and listen. Which didn't actually happen. But it was a wonderful thing to find 40 or 50 years later to meet up with this lady who had a pretty tragic life in many ways herself. And to say, you do realise, Colin, that I was your first therapist. And I said, no, what do you mean? She then gave me the story from her side and said, well, we were invited by your parents, mother and I, to come to your home in Wales and have tea. And the hope was that you and I would become friends. And I said, well, that did happen. But she said the reason for it was so if you had problems about your experience, you would talk to me about them. And I thought, and I said to her, well, at the time, I thought it was the last thing you wanted to know, to be bored stiff by something that was an evident male activity for a young lady like you. And I found myself, it was rather embarrassing to be confronted with a female friend at an age when I was going to a male school and I was not very well adept dealing with females of any age, because I only had a younger brother and there were no other young 11, 12 year old ladies that I knew. And the whole situation where a range of barriers, all invisible, and still are. I mean, the other day, it was extraordinary, they're just in this little row of houses. One of the young lads was at school, and they were recounting the Battle of Britain and saying that some of the children of their age were being sent overseas. And he said, you'd like to know, wouldn't you, that here's little boys of your age going abroad without their parents. And, you know, what do you think about that? And this little boy piped up and said, I know somebody. The teacher said, you can't. He said, yes, he lives across. He's a grey-haired man with his wife's rosary. She's the local exercise teacher. And, you know, the history still goes on in the most incredible way. And I've given talks at some schools about my experiences. And quite amazingly, the children were genuinely interested because they realised that at the time I was their age. And I reflect that at the time when I was 11, I wasn't that interested in World War One. But then, of course, the children in World War One were not involved to any great extent in this country, apart from a few air raids. Life went on relatively normally in World War One. But World War Two, the children were involved, and the whole shadow of the war involved the entire population of the country. And so the children are interested, and my grandchildren are interested in this aspect of it too, because I can identify with them and they can identify with me in this enormous gap of 60 odd years, in this coming together. In many ways, I feel that in my mindset, I've never grown out of that problem. The grief's still there. People sort of say, oh, you'll get over it, but you don't. And there's no doubt about it, and I'm not alone, there's other people. You've seen war veterans from World War One, World War Two, who go on and say, you just don't know what it was like. Because it's in there, it's ingrained, and will be never eradicated. It's indelible. And I think that people who haven't been through those kind of experiences don't appreciate that the old time was a great healer. Well, it certainly will reduce the problems, but it doesn't eliminate them. The scars are there. And I think my whole life has been trying to live through it. And it's a highly emotional situation. It's the strongest part of our mental capabilities, is the emotions. Fear. And I know that when I was in the Navy at the age of 18, there was a debate about whether I should wear my oak leaf medal on my uniform. And because it's a civilian award, you wear it on the right side of your shoulder rather than war awards, which are left shoulder. And I really couldn't come face this kind of conflict. What have you got that badge on that shoulder for? What's that for? So, and then when the Navy heard about it, they insisted that if I didn't wear the award, I was improperly dressed. And this caused awful problems. How does the oak leaf get put on the uniform? Which way round? Nobody to give you any advice and everything else. And the whole scenario comes up again at the age of 18. And the whole thing becomes hugely embarrassing as you're trying to explain the situation to people who are genuinely inquisitive, naturally. But it doesn't help you. In fact, if anything, it turns the knife in the wound over and over and over again. So when it came that I did my national service, I really looked round for a job, and I had absolutely no idea, but none whatsoever. I had no enthusiasm for any job whatsoever. The future ahead of me was blank, totally blank. I felt that the National Service might help me sort myself out to find what my proficiencies were, but they didn't. Didn't know what my skills were, because I'm not trained for anything. I'd not debated this with any careers advisor or anybody to say, well, what do you want to do in life, Colin? All I had in my mind was to join the Navy in some way, to give back what had been taken away in whatever shape or form. And I suppose my whole life has been left in that kind of blank. And it's been, in many ways, most unhappy from their deep point of view. I mean, yes, I have had happiness with people who've been around me, my family, my wife, my wives, because I've been divorced. Again, I found it very vulnerable, and I have a whole feeling that people can be taken so far along this trauma line before you move into an area of total despondency and despair and depression. And I've always felt that I've just kept my head above water, if you pardon the pun, from what I've had experienced and what I'm trying to go through and live through now. And at a time in my business life, when I worked in the Lloyd's insurance market, because that seemed about the nearest to the sea I'd ever get now, I began to feel these waves of immense depression, and at a time when it was going hard for me in my work, I just gave up on my marriage, and I really just found there was no, I could see no point in it. My father had died of cancer at the age of 59. And what was then, if you like, a body blow to my soul, was my mother committed suicide. She took an overdose, she was a diabetic, and she was a realist, and she realised that my father had made no real provision for the future in the way of finance. She'd lived a very full life, a very happy life. And she was totally, my father and she were totally together. And she had been a realist in the fact that if my father died, she knew what she would do. And she did do it. She did. She took an overdose of tablets, and I was there. I didn't realise what was going on. We'd seen Father die in hospital, and we came home. She listened to some records, and I gently tried to ask her, you know, what her plans were, or what she wanted to do, and she just said she'd write some letters and a few other business things she needs to do. And I stayed with her, and I told my wife what I was doing. I'd stay the night in Dad's bed, the next room. My mother asked me if I'd like supper, and I just said I'd have something light. I wasn't feeling too good because my father had died, and she was obviously in distress and didn't want to go to any great labour. And I was rather strangely appalled to see why, but after it, something I did at the time though, she was making some chopped chocolate sauce. And I had a savoury, and that's it. Why was she making hot chocolate sauce? I usually had it with ice cream, but I didn't want any. And I knew she didn't want any. And I tucked myself up in bed, in my father's bed, and looked at his watch and everything around. And my mother came in and gave me a long, long goodnight kiss. Crying a bit. She went into her room with the two dogs that she had. And I, in the middle of the night, I was aware the dogs were in a bit of pain or making a noise or something, and I told them not to, and rebuked them and said, be quiet. And I went in the morning with a cup of tea to my mother, and she was dead. And she'd given the dogs an overdose as well. And from there on, my first marriage really went to pieces as far as I was concerned. We had a joint funeral, my parents, enormously attended, because my father by this time had been a well-known Queen's Counsel, and magnificent work in the law courts, were very well respected and loved by everybody. And I thought this was another big challenge in my life, and this one was one that I hadn't got the inner resources to handle, and within a few years my relation with my first wife wasn't her fault, wasn't my fault. We had two children and she couldn't have any more, and I knew she loved children, so we adopted two children. And then of course has now become quite famous as Anna Radcliffe on the television. But suddenly I ran out of what is it you ran out of. And I wanted a divorce. I did not want to go on. I was living in my house my father had designed by my brother, who's an architect. It was a beautiful house. And when my parents died, my brother said, "Would you like the house, Colin? I've designed it, the plot is there in Virginia Water." And I thought, well, yes, there's no point in not having it. It was down to my parents' design. It was almost as if it was a shrine to them. And I just went along with whatever was happening. My parents left quite a large sum of money, which we divided between my brother and I. And I think my brother was equally upset about the situation, because I think he knew how I felt and was upset for me as well as for his own emotions. And my wife, bless her, she lives down the road, she found it was very difficult because they I became very secluded. I was unable to open my heart. Talk about the things that worried me.
Do you date this back to the... Oh,
definitely.
Think, yes.
Definitely. The whole of my life has been living on this kind of scenario. The interesting thing is that other people who have survived this thing, who, like Derek, for example, I think that his story was that he was in a lifeboat. It went along. Nothing very much occurred. I don't think he saw many people die. And so his perception of the tragedy is entirely different from mine. I'm not saying he's not insensitive, he's a sensitive person as well. But this is because my perception is so much at the emotional end, the deep emotional end of seeing people die. And as far as I was concerned, I took this all on board. And people sort of say to me, "Well, do you feel a regret that you didn't die as well?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't. I said, I just feel terrible hurt for them and their families." And as you can see, this shadow just goes on and on and on.
I find sometimes talking to survivors of the Holocaust, who have a very similar reaction to yours, that it's guilt they feel for surviving. Do you have any?
No, I don't have the guilt. I have just the fear of the experience, which people say will go, but it won't go. I mean, I can understand the Holocaust. I'm very much in tune with the people of the Holocaust, because for some reason or other they were not selected for the gas irons. And maybe it was because they had a skill, or they were the right age, or the right sex, or whatever it was. And I watched Schindler's List, that film, with tears in my eyes. And I could see it all happening, and I could understand the whole scenario. Even from the German point of view, I could see it. When the German officer gets up and inspects his rifle and cleans it, goes through the barrel, looks around for a target to shoot, he sees a small little girl in a little red coat and just shoots her. Says one might shoot a target. And I can feel both his scenario as well as the people who watch that ghastly act. And that